So yesterday we talked about biliary tract cancers, and right now we're going to talk about hepatocellular cancer. We have Sumi Vatiganana, also from the Florida Cancer Specialist, who was here earlier this morning. Dr. Tom Abrams from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and Dr. Ahmed Kaseb from the MD Anderson Cancer Center. How you doing, everybody?
Good.
So we're going to start out talking about a little bit of data, and then we'll get into a case that Sumi has. But Tom, let's talk about one of the more interesting questions in oncology, and I think it's going to get even more complicated now with a couple other new developments, upfront treatment of systemic treatment of HCC.
No doubt. Well, thank you for having me, Neil. This is it's a wonderful forum. So I'm going to be talking about current treatments in HCC. And we can start out with some disclosures. And I'll start out with a study that I think most of you are probably pretty familiar with, the IMbrave 150, which pitted atezolizumab and bevacizumab against what was then the standard of care, which was sorafenib. Patients were randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion. They had either locally advanced or metastatic unresectable HCC and had no prior therapy. So this was all first-line treatment-naive patients. Patients were stratified by region that they were from, Asia versus rest of the world. They had good performance status. They had preserved liver function. And they were also stratified by whether the presence of macrovascular invasion at extrahepatic spread and 400 was a cutoff for stratification of AFP. The primary endpoints were overall survival and PFS as independently assessed. There were 500 patients in the study, and treatment was continued until loss of clinical benefit or unacceptable toxicity. And so this was really a positive trial. It showed that this combination was very, very significantly better than sorafenib. Median overall survival was 19.2 months versus 13.4 months. And as you can see here, the updated overall survival showed that this benefit is maintained throughout the 6-month, 12-month, and 18-month milestones. So it's not as if the benefit started shrinking. And certainly that's a very positive development in a disease in which generally, up to that point, there was a very short progression-free survival and overall survival. Safety actually was showed that the atezo-bev arm was preferable. The toxicities, as you'd expect, were highly different. Diarrhea and PPE were significant in the sorafenib arm. Some more decreased appetite. There was significant hypertension in both arms, which you would expect from sorafenib and you'd expect from bevacizumab. But then the immune toxicities such as hepatitis and then infusion reactions, pancreatitis, hypothyroidism, they were higher in the atezo-bev arm. There was also a lot of proteinuria, as you'd expect, in the bevacizumab arm. But and more so than in the sorafenib arm. It brings us to the next study, which was the Himalaya study. That was an open-label, multi-center, global phase 3 trial looking at the STRIDE regimen, which is a single dose of tremelimumab at 300 milligrams, then with durvalumab, 1,500 milligrams every 4 weeks, and then durvalumab monotherapy, and sorafenib 400 milligrams twice daily. There was also a third arm, four consecutive doses of tremelimumab 75 milligrams every 4 weeks. That was closed. It was same eligibility requirements as in the IMbrave 150 trial. Stratification factors, macrovascular invasion, etiology of the liver disease, HBV, HCV versus other forms of cirrhosis. And performance status, and the primary overall primary objective was overall survival for the STRIDE regimen, the T300 plus durvalumab, And the key secondary objections were, objective was overall survival for durvalumab versus sorafenib. Then there was additional secondary objectives, PFS, response rate, duration of response, and safety. The response rates were higher in the T300 plus D arm, 20%, with 3% CR. Durvalumab monotherapy had a response rate of 17%. And there was a small response rate of 5% in the sorafenib arm. But the disease control rates were actually quite similar because there was a lot of stable disease in the sorafenib arm. Median time to response was the same in T300 plus D versus durvalumab and slightly longer, about 4 months in sorafenib. And the percentage of patients remaining in response at 12 months was similar in all arms. But here's sort of the interesting data. You have the median overall survival of 16.4 months for STRIDE regimen and 13.7 months in sorafenib, which is actually longer than it was in the atezo-bev arm, the IMbrave. But you have a very long 5-year updated overall survival. So milestones, 18 months, 24 months, 36 months, 48 months, and 5 years, you see that that overall survival advantage is maintained versus sorafenib. And certainly that's highly impressive that we even have a chunk of 5-year survivors with advanced HCC. It was really not something we saw very often. And then if you add in, if you just subtract all the patients that didn't have any disease control, you see that the 5-year overall survival is even more significantly different between patients who received durva-tremi versus sorafenib. And then this is a confusing slide because it has multiple, it's a sort of 4D, but essentially what it's saying is that patients treated with the durva-tremi versus sorafenib, more patients at 5 years were still alive, they were still on the study treatment, and received fewer subsequent therapies, mostly because they were still on the original therapy. And subsequent therapy was initiated later in patients who were randomized to the durva-tremi arm versus sorafenib. And as you can see, the change from baseline, there were many more deeper responses in the immunotherapy arm. Immune-mediated events for the T300 plus D versus the durvalumab monotherapy arm, predictably you saw more events, roughly double the amount of grade 3 or 4 events in the doublet arm. In particular, you saw more hepatitis, you saw more hypothyroidism, you saw more rashes, and you saw more diarrhea in the doublet arms.
So before you go on into some of the newer upfront therapies that are going to make this even more complicated, Ahmed, I'm kind of curious right now how you're sorting it out between the two approved approaches of STRIDE and atezo-bev, starting out with what will get you to not want to use atezo-bev because of the bev?
Yeah, so only when it is risky. So all of us are still using atezo-bev, has got higher response rate, higher survival advantage. So if there is a main concern about bleeding, for example, those patients who have very risky varices or just had banding or just had bleeding, so those are the patients that would be candidates for the immunotherapy alone, dual checkpoint inhibition. Or I've been seeing this more in the community as well, if you couldn't get the EGD done in a reasonable time frame.
So, Tom, again, any thoughts about this question? And also tolerability. I don't know. I'm curious, Sumi, have you used the durva-tremi for HCC?
I haven't used it.
And that's a common, response. I think most people in the community just use atezo-bev. Any thoughts, Tom, about tolerability of complications with the two regimens?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that they're both extremely well tolerated. I think that one of the advantages to STRIDE is that it, you know, is it's just fewer visits to the doctor. It's once every 4 weeks. It's quick. You don't have the necessity to monitor for proteinuria, which happens to almost all patients on Bev, who remain on it for a long time. So I think it does make it a little easier on patients, some of whom may live far away. And I think it's important to note that that it may, and we don't really know this, but it may be advantageous to forego a VEGF targeted therapy, because that's really all you have in the second line are treatments that target VEGF. So I think there's room for both, essentially. And for patients who are a little bit more frail, I think Himalaya makes a lot of sense. For younger patients who I think can handle the Bev, Atezo-Bev is a fine regimen.
So Ahmed, another issue is a patient with poor liver function. A lot of these patients have that. Child-Pugh-B, for example. I'm curious how you approach that and any role for single agent IO. The data there with the durvalumab alone looked pretty good too.
Yeah, that's a great question. Needless to say, for our HCC patients, this is not uncommon scenario. So that's one of the other advantages, like Tom was talking about, you know, the tolerability. So we all have treated patients with both regimens, and we know that this is a more tolerable regimen. So in general, patients with Child-Pugh-B, not all of them are the same. So Child-Pugh-B7, for example, all of us would still approach them and treat them. My choice for them most of the time would be the Himalaya regimen. If they are like B8, you know, ascites being drained every week, then I go for Durva alone. So that's the only scenario where I use only single agent when I'm really worried about the liver function status. In fact, there is a study presented about the ALBI score for the Himalaya, and also another one, ALBI score, which is subset analysis of the Child-Pugh-A based on the ALBI calculation. And for the Atezo-Bev, patients did poorly if they were ALBI-2, while on Himalaya, both of them did the same.
So, Tom, another point I've heard brought up, actually Rich Finn brought this up at a program we did recently, is he's pointing out that, you know, some of these Child-Pugh-B are not the cirrhosis, it's a tumor. And in many cases, a patient that maybe have been, you know, this is a recent deterioration because of tumor. You know, Rich treats breast cancer too, and he, you know, kind of made the analogy to visceral crisis and said, we don't pull back on therapy when a patient's in visceral crisis. And he talks about that scenario where the patient actually was doing well and it's the tumor causing problem.
Yeah, I think you can. It's sometimes difficult to tease that out, but there are certainly patients who you can see as you know, they've really had rapid progression. Something's been followed, you know, for a while, and nothing's been done, and then their liver function really deteriorated as the tumor exploded. You know, for those patients, I think it's not unreasonable to try to give the regimen that is going to, in your mind, give you the best chance of shrinkage to restore liver function. Child-Pugh, as we know, is not a perfect analysis of one's liver function. It's a lot different for a patient who has hepatic encephalopathy and refractory ascites than a patient who may have you know, had a spike in their bilirubin because they developed an acute biliary obstruction from extrinsic compression of the tumor.
So I'm going to be real curious. So the next time we meet, actually, we usually do the retreat every fall with the Florida Cancer Specialist in Orlando. I'm curious what we're going to be talking about there, because there are a couple other regimens that look pretty exciting.
Yeah. So the nivolumab plus ipilimumab was evaluated in CheckMate 9DW. Again, sorafenib was one of the control arms, but you could use sorafenib or lenvatinib. So I think this is really a more accurate control arm, a better control arm, and in this case, 80 to 85% of patients received lenvatinib instead of sorafenib, which, you know, we're using much more lenvatinib than sorafenib. So this is, I think, a much better control arm, doing the dealer's choice. Patients were randomized 1-to-1. They had Child-Pugh 5 or 6. ECOG performance status was 0 or 1. and primary endpoint was overall survival. Secondary endpoints were the typical response rate, duration of response, and time to stable disease. So overall survival was, again, really significantly improved in the Nivo-Ipi arm. Median overall survival was 23.7 months in the Nivo-Ipi arm and 20.6 months in the lenvatinib arm, which really I think is testament to the fact that lenvatinib is superior treatment to sorafenib. But this improved outcome was held at 24 months and at 36 months. And in fact, if anything, it got stronger as time went on. Again, you sort of see the same treatment-related adverse events with ipi-nivo versus some of the other immune therapies. Maybe a little bit worse on the hepatitis AST-ALT. More pancreatitis here than with other things. But again, you know, lenvatinib, sorafenib, a lot of hypertension, a lot of diarrhea, a lot of PPE, and a lot of proteinuria. So I think this is really, you know, it's another option, another perhaps even better option than what we have already. And now we have another regimen, camrelizumab with rivaserinib, which is a TKI. So it's a regimen. We've been testing a lot of studies be negative looking at treatments with PD-1 inhibitors versus and TKIs. This is the first one that came out positive, although, again, sorafenib is the control arm, and this actually started accruing, I believe, after lenvatinib was approved. So a little unusual at the time to be using sorafenib as the control arm, but most of the patients were randomized in Asia. So I think that probably is responsible for that choice. But the and you can see the etiology was highly HBV 76% HBV. So this is not really going to be necessarily applicable to a Western group of patients, but highly interesting results. Primary endpoints, PFS and OS. And as you can see here, certainly PFS and OS were certainly significantly better in the camrelizumab Revo arm, and the toxicities. The subset analysis showed, you know, basically better in all aspects, especially with high AFP and toxicities. You have the expected toxicities of ALT rise, AST rise, hypertension. So nothing surprising here.
When you think about IO TKI, think about lenvatinib and pembro, and of course that didn't work out that great.
Yeah, I mean, I I'm not sure there's a lot of necessity for that pairing because you know that in the second line,
right,
you're going to be able to use TKIs. So do you really want to do that in the first line when you have, you know, tried and true methods that are probably at least as effective, if not more so? Again, you know, it's hard to compare these trials. They're all slightly different, but I do think that I don't see a patient population where I would definitely say that regimen makes sense. So there are, you know, certainly you still can use lenvatinib in the first line, and I think patients who have a history of autoimmune disease, Crohn's, hepatitis, autoimmune hepatitis, MS, RA, I think those patients, you want to use, you know, you could certainly use lenvatinib in the first line because you don't want to kick up their autoimmune disease. Certainly patients who've had organ transplantation, we're getting more experience in using IO in these patients, but there's such a high risk of losing the organ, especially if it's a liver, that I think it's, you know, it has to be done under very controlled circumstances. I would certainly, you know, for most patients, I wouldn't even think about using them, and I would go with lenvatinib. And then, you know, this is this is a pretty old study, but just to sort of show you how far we've come, the phase 3 trial of sorafenib versus placebo in 2008 by Lovay. It was a randomized trial of 600 patients for sorafenib versus placebo. And, you know, it did show a survival advantage, and it led to the first drug ever being approved for advanced HCC. Overall survival for the sorafenib arm at that point was, I think, you know, just under 11 months. Placebo was under 8 months. We've come a long way since then. And then just to wrap up, the REFLECT trial was a trial looking at lenvatinib versus sorafenib. It was a randomized phase 3 to detect non-inferiority. But ultimately, it met its endpoints. Median overall survival was slightly better in the lenvatinib arm. PFS significantly better, and the response rates were much higher. Ultimately, approved based on that outcome, and toxicities were better in general versus sorafenib.
So a couple of questions are coming in from the audience, and then I'd like to hear about this 49-year-old man with treated HIV who developed HCC, Sumi. But Shopa has an interesting question, Ahmed. The benefit of therapy in patients with hepatitis basis, cirrhosis versus MASH, and particularly the issue of IOs in general, I think.
Yeah, so there is a lot of meta-analysis, although retrospective, not pre-planned for these studies, that showed that the benefit in non-viral HCC with specifically single-agent immunotherapy or immunotherapy plus TKI was not as pronounced. And the main value of these regimens, the main survival advantage, was driven by the viral hepatitis. However, we didn't have any powered study to do so. So in light of this, in a patient, you know, this scenario here, very low risk varices here, grade 1 on beta blocker, I would still try to use atezo-bev here. And in these patients with non-viral, I usually tend to restage them at shorter interval. My usual restaging is 3 months. In these cases, I do 2 months, the first one, just to make sure. And the study actually did every 6 weeks. So the IMbrave 150 was restaging every 6 weeks.
Yeah, I would certainly, you know, agree that in general, patients with non-cirrhotic, viral cirrhotic etiologies, you know, they tend not to respond, but to treatments as well as those with viral etiology of cirrhosis. That said, it's sort of the same across the board, and so there's no real advantage, as I can see, for choosing one treatment versus another. So you still just want to use the best treatment and hope for the best.
So age-old Bev question from Dr. Kubler in the FCS. Ahmed, does asymptomatic proteinuria really matter with Bev? Ahmed?
Asymptomatic
proteinuria, does it matter?
Asymptomatic?
Proteinuria.
Yeah, I agree with Tom that this could be a real issue. So even if it is asymptomatic, but aligning with our historic, you know, guidelines and cutoff, 2 grams, I use the 2 grams protein in 24 hour. Even if it is asymptomatic, creatinine is fine. I still avoid bevacizumab. And if I have to use TKI, I go for something like sorafenib or lenvatinib, also with frequent monitoring, because they have the same side effect. And I get my nephrologists on board. They usually start ACE and ARB. So it goes to our multidisciplinary management weighing benefit-risk ratio.
So, Tom, a question here about using Himalaya after Embrave, but I would also bring up the issue of this Ipi-Nivo and where you see that heading and whether you think that's going to be a real consideration in the near future.
Yeah, so I think it's totally reasonable to use either Himalaya or Ipi-Nivo post atezo-bev. You know, this is dual checkpoint inhibition versus essentially, you know, IO monotherapy with bevacizumab. So they're different therapies. There's no question you can try this. I guess I would be, and without any data to support this, I would probably think more closely about Ipi-Nivo because you're getting 4 doses of Ipi. in the ipi/nivo, which may, you know, kind of enhance the difference between those two regimens. But once again, we don't really know, and unfortunately, we need more studies to kind of tease that out.
So it's amazing how many times the issue of indirect comparison of data sets has come up this whole weekend and come up in oncology. I'm not sure it's a terrible thing. I mean, you know, in the past, we would compare A versus B, and, you know, we maybe see some difference. But now, I think we're kind of looking for new agents, et cetera. But I am curious, Tom, do you see yourself, if you could, using ipi/nivo up front instead of either Embrave or
You know, I think the data are very, you know, very compelling. I don't know that they're that hugely different, but for a younger patient who's, you know, I think we're less concerned about the toxicity of the four doses of ipi. Yeah, I would have no qualms using it, and probably would use it preferentially.
So, Sumi, any questions? And do you want to bring up talk about your 49-year-old man?
Yeah. So I'm going to discuss this case, which I'm actually currently treating now. He's a pretty recent diagnosis. He's a 49-year-old heterosexual male who was diagnosed with HIV for many years, which is well controlled with undetectable viral load. Actually, the infectious disease doctor called me and said, I have this young man who has been well controlled HIV, doing really well, no hepatitis B or C, and he was complaining of this pain, the shoulder pain, some right upper quadrant discomfort. So they initially did a chest x-ray. They said some atelectasis on the right lobe, so followed by a CT scan, showed a large mass, about 13 by 14 by 14 centimeters, involving the right lobe of the liver, and this was followed an MRI, which basically showed the same thing, multi-lobulated enhancing mass, about 14 by 15 centimeters in size. He did go for a biopsy. The infectious disease doctor did all this even before I saw him, and showed that he came with a diagnosis of hepatocellular carcinoma. There was no normal liver tissue in the specimen, and there was necrosis and fibrosis, and it was moderate to poorly differentiated. And I did a CT chest. There were no other lesions, no mets. AFP was about 5,400. I repeated a B and C. Hepatitis, it was negative. I did do an NGS, and I did this on initial presentation, and basically showed a TP53 and a third promoter sequence DNA. So he was having a lot of pain, like really bad, that I had to start him on pain medications. And I started him on Atezo and Bev. As of January, he just started it. I think he got two treatments, and he's been tolerating well. The pain was better, the discomfort is better. He's still requiring some pain meds. And my next question, of course, he's going to see a transplant or a tertiary care center to get some. Because of the size, I just did my recertification board, so I had to go through all the criteria for transplant and resection and all that. So I was pretty comfortable starting him on therapy because of the symptoms, and that was the question I wanted to ask you. Is it like a bridging therapy? You know, I mean, is he a candidate for transplant if there is a significant reduction in size or other modalities?
And I guess another question she brought up to me, Tom, was any association between HIV and HCC?
I don't know of any association, but HIV certainly is a risk factor, or at least enhances the incidence of many, many cancers. It's hard to understand what the impact would be in a patient whose viral load is zero, but, you know, there may be some. We know that patients who, you know, had HCV treated and they're undetectable, cured of it, their risk of HCC is not zero. It's certainly quite high. So, I mean, it's a little different because there's damage to the liver. But I wouldn't be surprised if their risk of developing HCC is at least a little bit higher. And, you know, he could have had other risk factors, which we, you know, don't know about. I think the interesting thing is I would certainly treat him as well. You know, I think systemic therapy makes a lot of sense here. And I think the idea would be hopefully shrink the tumor to some point where he could maybe, if there isn't, you know, if it's possible, you know, it's right-sided, maybe he could have a surgery. Has he seen a liver surgeon yet, or is that...
Not yet.
Yeah. I mean, that, you know, these big tumors, occasionally you can get them out, and that, I think, would be a goal of therapy. You would always have a high risk of recurrence, but that would be, you know, highly preferable. As for transplantation, you know, right now he's well outside of the criteria, but if he had some shrinkage, it's certainly a possibility.
Which one would be better? He's 49 years old. Which one would you prefer for him, a transplant or a resection? What would give him the long-term overall survival or disease-free survival?
Yeah, I don't know how the HIV plays into it. I'm sure there are patients who have, you know, have well-controlled HIV who get, you know, organ transplantation. So I'm not thinking that that would disqualify him in any way. But, you know, if I were a patient, I'd probably want to at least try to have it resected rather than get a transplant up front. Although, you know, then again, if he gets a resection and then has metastatic recurrence, then, you know, he's then it's palliative from then on. So I think it's a tough thing, and I think it would be a decision that he would have to think about really closely and need some guidance there. Personally, though, I think if it's a solitary tumor, it's well circumscribed and it's resectable, that's probably how I would proceed.
So curious, Ahmed, any thoughts about this case? And also, any updates on adjuvant treatment? That seems like it's kind of on hold for the moment.
Yeah, so regarding this case, you know, I agree with all, you know, Tom's points. And you know, the dilemma here with HIV is the fact that we exclude them from all clinical trials, you know. So that's why it's hard. We don't know their natural history with HCC. But having said that, for a 49-year-old man, single tumor, no vascular invasion, no metastasis, I agree with atezobev, of course. We start this, you know, frontline, alpha-fetoprotein is 5,000. No surgeon or a transplant team would, even if this tumor was small, would consider him. I would also start looking into local therapy approaches. So if it is amenable for yttrium 90, for example, to maximize the efforts to shrink the tumor. And then the clinical dilemma here is going to be, and you're going to reach this either with this patient or others, once you get to a transplantable point, and then they less the patient, what would you do with immunotherapy? So they always ask us to hold immunotherapy at least 6 weeks. So in that case, I usually do maintenance with lenvatinib, to Tom's point that most of us use lenvatinib. So this is a scenario that's going to start coming up more frequently because of the high percentage of responders to immunotherapy. And regarding the adjuvant, Neil, so where we are now, we got excited a little bit a couple of years ago when the initial results of the IMbrave 050 adjuvant atezobev was initially positive. However, the follow-up, you know, showed negative results. So where we are now, we don't have anything approved yet. I wouldn't use any off-label agents. But the field is, there is a lot of excitement. There is a lot of phase 3 studies going on. So hopefully next year or the year after, we're going to have more updates in this area. Where we are now, I would not recommend it.
Tom, you know, we have AFP as a good biomarker, but any interest or any work being done on cell-free DNA?
Yeah, there certainly is. HCC does not have as much. Certainly, when HCC is confined to the liver, we don't see as much cell-free DNA positivity as you would expect. But it's certainly something that's used, and I think it's a promising biomarker. There's no question.
All right, Ahmed, let's talk about some other approaches to HCC.
Yes, so following Tom here, you know, his job was to look at the metastatic disease, advanced disease. My job now is pivoting to novel approaches here, and we're going to talk about approaches where we combine local and systemic therapy, especially in early stage disease, those patients who are amenable for surgery or patients amenable for local therapy. However, don't get your hopes high up because we don't really have, it's complicated. I'm going to talk like a politician now, but I'll show you why this is complicated. So this is my disclosure in terms of research support. So we're going to talk about updated data for the adjuvant treatment for early stage disease, also talking about the changing landscape in combining local therapy. The example here is TACE and systemic therapies in patients with unresectable HCC, and yet they are candidates for local therapies. So this is the select phase 3 studies here, Dervabev, Nivo, Pimpro, Atezobev, phase 3 studies compared to active surveillance. So this is the updated analysis, RFS, which, you know, the initial benefit at 1 year was lost upon further follow-up here. And the survival analysis as well showed no positive results. So there is a very, very important drug warning now, because some of us in the community setting were still using it off-label based on the initial data, and also trying to look at higher risk patients to justify it. But this is an FDA, you know, contraindication at this point, not to use it even off-label. So that takes us to the overall rationale for pre or post surgery for HCC. And there is a very strong rationale here. This is an immune microenvironment rich tumor. So you see here immune cell, you see rationale for doing it either before or after. There is also very strong rationale to doing that. So that way, before surgery, and the tumor is still there, the microenvironment is still there to stimulate and activate those cells. And that would be beneficial either before or after surgery. Adjuvantly, vaccines are also evolving now in this space, because this ability to enhance the innate immunity and enhance the CD4 and CD8 immune cell infiltration. So we actually did a study with new adjuvant Nivo Epi here, and showed just that. Out of 20 patients, 6 of them achieved major pathologic response defined by at least 50%. Actually, 5 of them had 100% necrosis. And you see here what I was talking about, the infiltration of the cytotoxic T cells was the determinant factor for response at time of surgery, and none of these patients recurred. And this is after 5 to 6 years now of follow-up post-surgery for those patients. So the bottom line is, if you don't have high baseline cytotoxic cells, you got to be able to find a way, including vaccine, for example, any strategy to increase the cytotoxic T cell population. And that would really make a difference whether we're doing it neoadjuvantly or adjuvantly. And this is a meta-analysis of similar other studies that looked into neoadjuvant, like our similar to our study here. And across the board here, you see patients who either had pathologic complete response or major pathologic response driving the benefit here, and none of these patients recurred. And the cutoff point, there is a meta-analysis recently, 70% of the necrosis effect at time of surgery, the agreed upon cutoff point for those kinds of studies if you're going to do neoadjuvant treatment trial design. Similarly, we have an Atezobev study. We actually concluded the first cohort here, 13 cases, and we saw only one patient who had 100% necrosis, another one 70% necrosis, even though 6 patients showed PR, partial response, some of them 70% partial response on the imaging. So it tells us the story has got more and more to it, rather than just imaging response or biomarker response. So even those patients with 50 to 70% reduction in tumor size, none of them achieved 70% necrosis, or what we call major pathologic response. So it is going to be also regimen dependent. And this is just here to showcase that never write off the old, you know, approaches such as radiation, for example, here. And this is just to draw our attention to this. This is neoadjuvant versus adjuvant radiation here, and almost double the survival benefit here. So this is also something that we should look forward to. Even if you don't have room for systemic therapy and the patient has a single tumor, you could, in a multidisciplinary manner, discuss with your radiation team, your IR team. We've done sometimes neoadjuvant yttrium-90 for single tumors. So this is why it's really a multidisciplinary kind of discussion, even in surgical disease, especially for those higher risk patients, alpha fetoprotein more than 400 in poorly differentiated tumors, and so on. So now let's go switch gears here to the patients who are candidates for localized therapies. So in other in another word, is there a role for combining systemic and local therapies in intermediate, you know, stage, those patients who are candidates for localized therapies? And again, you know, a pivotal phase 3 studies ongoing, lenvatinib pimpro plus TACE versus TACE alone, Dervabev, I'm going to present that, Nivo Epi versus Nivo versus all of them together with TACE versus TACE alone, Atezobev plus TACE versus TACE alone and Rigo-Nivo as well. So this is EMERALD-1 study. Most of us have heard about this study reaching the primary endpoint of a significant enhancement in the progression-free survival. Overall survival has not been reported yet. Points here to remember from the inclusion criteria of EMERALD, they included patients with even patients with vascular invasion as well, VP1 and VP2, the branches of portal vein invasion. And also they allowed up to 4 TACE procedures. So you can only imagine those patients might have had many, many tumors or very large tumors, and then they categorize all arms based on the use of 1, 2, 3 versus 4 or more, and they were you know, more or less the same, so we don't think there is bias there. And in terms of safety, it was what you would expect from the regimen, so there was no surprises there. So the Achilles heel here is waiting for the overall survival. EMERALD-3 is another study that just completed recruitment. Derva, Tremi, plus TACE, plus or minus lenvatinib compared to TACE alone. And here, if you look at the inclusion criteria as well, you will see identical criteria to EMERALD-1. No systemic disease, no extrahepatic disease. However, they allowed VP1 and VP2 to be included here. And then LEAP-012 study, that's pembrolizumab here, plus TACE compared to TACE alone. And the point here to remember is that they were very stringent in terms of recruitment. You look at the eligibility criteria, no portal vein thrombosis was allowed or extrahepatic disease. More importantly, patients were allowed to enroll if they had treatable tumor by TACE with either 1 or 2 sessions. So avoiding those very large tumors, multiple tumors, so that way we're very much reflecting what's going on in the community setting with the TACE population. And you see here very significant progression-free survival difference here, 14.6 versus 10 months. Overall survival, however, didn't reach statistical significance, but there was a trend there. And then, of course, in terms of treatment-related adverse events, again, what you would expect from this combination, so there was no major concerns here. So the answer here is combining local and systemic would definitely carry the promise of controlling the local hepatic tumors, delaying liver failure, and potentially improving overall survival. However, we are still waiting for significant results. The OS benefit is still under investigation here, and larger randomized studies are still needed. So to conclude here, so recent advances in immunotherapy in this area, in the intermediate stage and patients eligible for localized therapies, are being translated into a higher response rate, improved PFS. However, we're still waiting for positive OS data, specifically also looking into predictive biomarkers here to identify candidates. And new therapeutic strategies to lower IO resistance are emerging. We talked about vaccines in terms of resectable disease here, and that way we can combine it with immunotherapy, increase the percentage of pathologic responders, and also in the adjuvant setting to lower recurrence rate. Therefore, integrating immunotherapy into early stage, which is operable disease, for example, here we talked about, requires understanding of the benefit-risk ratio, TME, tumor microenvironment, also looking into the specific regimens to address resistance to immunotherapy, and designing future studies in this space, resectable disease or a local therapy amenable disease, would really need to be very, very focused and granular down to etiology, underlying liver disease, even tumor characteristics. You didn't see in any of the studies I presented here any stratification or selection based on the vascularity, for example, even though we all know, we presented those cases at the tumor board, and they reject those tumors with infiltrative margins or hypovascular, and yet we're not integrating it into trials here. And therefore, larger studies with global participation would be a key to address all of these issues and lower disparity in healthcare and trial access.
So, Tom, getting back to this issue of combining local therapy and systemic therapy, you know, when you indirectly look at, you know, particularly with Atezo-Bev, what you see it's not that much different than combining it with TACE. And I guess the question is, does it make more sense just to start out with systemic therapy and bring in TACE or, you know, radiolabeled therapy later?
I absolutely think that that's the way it should be, because you can get a tremendous response out of systemic therapy alone. So, you know, why combine right off the bat? I don't see a huge advantage there. And in fact, it makes it more difficult to measure the success of systemic therapy if you muddy the waters by giving a local therapy right off the bat, because generally, you know, radiographically, it becomes more difficult to interpret. And so I think, given the fact that you're going to have a chunk of patients who are going to have really nice responses to systemic therapy, you can save local therapies for somewhere down the road. Not necessarily a time of progressive disease, but once you've achieved some disease stability and you can kind of look at it and say, I think this is probably the best we're going to get, let's now give you some local therapy to perhaps synergize or increase the shrinkage, because we're trying to get patients to a point at which they can eventually be resected or go to transplantation.
So, you know, Sumi, I used to have oncologists come up to me before we do HGC sessions and say, these patients are getting TACE so much by the time they get to me, I can't even treat them. And I wonder if things are getting better. You think the word's getting out in the community to the interventional radiologists, hey, now we have some things that actually, you know, Tezobev particularly caused a good response rate? Or are you still seeing patients kind of getting multiple TACEs before they get to you?
Where I practice, we have a great interventional radiologist who's actually part of Florida Cancer Specialists. So he's very much aware of the treatment. So he, when he does those TACE or, you know, he does a lot of invasive techniques, he says, get them on some systemic therapy. So he calls and lets us know. So I think we are fortunate to have, you know, somebody like that in the community to be able to do those local therapies, and we can do the systemic therapy.
All right, let's hear about your 74-year-old man.
So this is a case which is not current, but which I, you know, unfortunately lost this patient. He has a history of hepatitis C. He was treated with Harvoni in the past. He's been in, you know, a viral load undetectable in remission. Also had some lymphadenopathy. He has some other chronic conditions. He had a brachial plexus neuropathy, some diverticulitis. I was seeing him for the CLL, actually, which was just monitoring him. And then he happened to have, again, a similar presentation with abdominal pain, which prompted radiological studies showing a 12 centimeters liver mass, which was initially read as a hemangioma on the regular CT scan. And then we did a triple phase, which showed that it was consistent with, you know, malignancy, the cancer. So he did have the biopsy, which was positive. It was poorly differentiated. Repeated the Hep B and C was undetectable viral load. So at that time, I started him on the Bev and the Atezo, which he responded very well. I mean, I remember he was at Thanksgiving dinner, and his family was like looking at him like it was his last Thanksgiving. And he continued to respond for about a year, and he went back to the next Thanksgiving dinner, and they were surprised to see him. So to be still there, and he was doing well. So he had about 19 months of disease response, and then he started progressing. Then I started him on a TKI, the Lenva, about 8 milligrams, not a higher dose, and it didn't work. 2-3 months, you know, it started with no response. So at that point, we decided, you know, what was there to do. So I said, maybe some chemo. That's what I wanted to ask. Is there a role for any chemotherapy for hepatocellular CA? He really didn't respond. He started, you know, having cirrhosis, portal hypertension, and he succumbed to the disease.
Tom, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly are data supporting use of FOLFOX, and there have been phase 2 studies looking at GemCis and GemOx, and there are response rates, but I think in general, cytotoxic chemotherapy just doesn't work very well. The FOLFOX data is hard to understand based on my own use of it, because there was a point at which that study came out. I was using, you know, FOLFOX not, you know, more than a handful of times, and I never saw any responses. To me, it just didn't really work very well. I don't know if you had a different opinion about it, but
no, I agree. And you know, this era of chemotherapy in HCC has been gone for a long time because of this issue of it affects the underlying cirrhosis and it accelerates these complications. And I think in this to your point about what to do for patients who responders and then they start progressing, and in my mind I look at it from the two guiding principles here. One is this oligoprogression and they're still tolerating therapy well, in that case I add local therapy. So this is one of the cases where you add local therapy even to metastatic disease. And then also the argument we always try to make to the local therapy teams that, if you're not going to do your treatment in one session, so that's always, the guiding principle in my practice. If it is one tumor that is amenable for TACE or ablation, that's fine. But if you're going to have to do it 2-3 times and leave untreated tumors in between your sessions to grow, then this is something that we really have to address. So upfront, I would do systemic therapy. The argument is very simple, to a point where if you're not going to do your local therapy in one session, this patient should be on immunotherapy or systemic therapy. And those patients, 1/3 of them will actually have nice response. And at least 40-50% will have stable disease. So you can really address all tumors in one session and with immunotherapy and systemic therapy. And then down the line, you can argue that you could bring local therapy back to this oligoprogression, residual disease. So we still are needing the help of local therapy teams. Actually, every patient on systemic therapy in my practice, the day before, I review their scans with the local therapy team, if there is any room to introduce local therapy for them to enhance response.
So we're going to move on. Thank you so much.